It is difficult, my friends, to characterize the year 1962. It has been called a year of crisis, a year of confrontation. But as the year drew to a close, it was marked also by a considerable relaxation in international tensions. Fear gave way to a glimmer of hope, and the year closes on a note of what you might call subdued confidence. Domestically, the year 1962, viewed on balance, was a fairly good year. As one writer put it, 1962 was a year when businessmen thought something worse was just around the corner, but it turned out not to be. The national income was high. Corporation profits reached a record high in many instances. Our people were at work. Unemployment, though high, was not alarmingly so. The stock market did plunge badly in the spring of the year. Some of you may recall, as if to prove again, if proof were needed, that a law of gravitation is an operation in the financial world as in the physical world. That which goes up too sharply must as sharply come down. The rabbis had a proverb, Zrok hutra avira, haikra kai. You pitch rocks into the air, they will come down. And that's true also of stocks that are pitched too high in the air. They come down. But the market recovered before it could stampede our people into an economic panic. Some people maintain that our rate of material growth has not kept pace with that of other industrial nations. And so proposals are being made for tax reform and a tax cut in order to stimulate business and create greater consumer demand. But by and large, 1962 has been a satisfactory year business-wise. And business analysts forecast a good year for 1963. Much has been said and written about the Cuban crisis, which blew up so suddenly in October of this last year. In no time, we were facing an imminent threat of thermonuclear war. Our government came upon incontrovertible proof that the Soviet Union was secretly constructing a bastion of vast military power in Cuba, erecting missile bases and importing jet bombers into that island, only 90 miles distant from our shores. If successful, This could have resulted in a most sinister shift in the balance of power between the East and the West. We were, by way of being dangerously outmaneuvered, and so sharply our government called a halt. It declared a quarantine on all offensive weapons and equipment under shipment to Cuba. And the armed forces of our country were ordered to prepare for any eventuality. And the stage was set for a showdown in which the giants of the earth would be pitted one against the other. But suddenly, the Kremlin yielded. The Soviet missiles and bombers were withdrawn. The United States naval quarantine was ended. And a world collision whose appalling consequences no one even dared to imagine was averted. Our success in the Cuban crisis has undoubtedly given our country immeasurable prestige, not alone in the Western Hemisphere, but throughout the free world and the unaligned world, the so-called unaligned world. The disastrous political and diplomatic defeat which we suffered in the Bay of Pigs in 1961 was more than offset in October 1962. Mr. Khrushchev himself has told his people and the world, communist world, that the United States is not to be looked upon as a paper tiger. For this tiger, he said, has atomic teeth. Now, the Cuban outcome has renewed the confidence of the American people. Has renewed the confidence of the American people first in the political competence and the sound leadership of its president. It has, for a time at least, silenced the warmongers at home. And it is, in my judgment, likely that what transpired in October will point the way towards a new way of doing business between the world powers. A less belligerent approach to the solution of international problems in the future. And that henceforth, neither East nor West will need to resort to threats of war and to act bordering on war before agreeing, as they ultimately must, to negotiation and mutual accommodation. Khrushchev will hereafter have to practice what he preaches if he wants peace and abide literally by his program of coexistence without the subterfuge of assisting so-called movements of liberations in other countries, hoping in that way to extend the frontiers of communism in the world. There will be less shoe-thumping on conference tables in the future, and less megathon bomb intimidations. And we ourselves will perhaps be less hesitant to take, when necessary, a step backward from positions previously held in order to take two steps forward on the road to a peaceful world. During the past week, the Cuban government released some 1,160 prisoners who were captured during the ill-fated invasion of 1961. And many of their close relatives were also allowed to leave Cuba. And in exchange, Cuba received some $50 million worth of medicines, baby foods, which it greatly needs. Is it too much to hope that a thaw in the relationship of our two countries may set in before long? Cuba, secured now against invasion, may perhaps wish to reappraise her unfavorable economic position and her political isolation in the Western Hemisphere, and consider the advisability of a new rapprochement with a strong and close neighbor, the United States of America, whose people never harbored any ill will towards the people of Cuba. Now, the President of the United States forced Khrushchev to retreat by threat of force. But the President of the United States was actually compelled to use force to compel Governor Ross Barnett of Mississippi to submit to the authority of the United States. 500 marshals, National Guardsmen, and federal troops had to be sent into Oxford, Mississippi, in order to protect the right of a Negro, James Meredith, to register as a student in the University of Mississippi. Two federal courts, presided over by Southern judges, had ordered Meredith's admission to the university. But Governor Barnett had vowed that, to use his words, he would rot in jail before he would let one Negro darken the sacred threshold of our white schools. And he personally interposed his authority as governor of Mississippi and prevented James Meredith from registering. He defied the federal government in Washington. He appealed to the people of Mississippi to back him up in this defiance in the name of states' rights, 100 years after the Civil War. And passions were thus wildly inflamed, so that when United States marshals arrived in Oxford, a disgraceful riot broke out, which lasted all through the night of September 30th, an ex-Major General Edwin Walker harangued the crowd and urged it on to acts of violence. A mob of 2,500 charged and attacked the marshals. Rocks, bricks, bottles were hurled at them. Cars were overturned and set on fire. 160 marshals were injured. Two men, one a foreign correspondent, were killed. Tear gas had to be used to quell the rioters, whose savagery, whose racist madness and fury shocked the entire nation and the world. Federal authority was finally established in Mississippi. James Meredith is now registered and is attending classes at the university, guarded by federal marshals. But this dark and tragic episode confronted all Americans, proud of their country and its traditions of human rights, with some very bitter facts. Not one faculty member of the University of Mississippi, not one faculty member of the 200 at the university spoke out during the violent agitation which attended the registration. Meredith spoke out in favor of compliance with a federal court order to admit him. Not one. Practically the entire clergy of the city of Oxford remained silent. The very men who preach brotherly love and often quote in their pulpits from the Bible, which declares that God made of one blood all the peoples of the earth. And only here and there did a newspaper in Mississippi denounce the governor of the state for defying the federal authorities and defying the federal courts and for inciting to disobedience and rioting. The solid, respectable white citizens of Mississippi were nearly all behind the governor, not to speak of the student body. In all this, one sees clearly the dread, dark heritage of the past, how deep the abyss still is, and how long and steep is the road which men must climb to overcome their primordial race prejudices and hates. Even men who live in a free and democratic country, even men who belong to the so-called better classes of society. This was a very humbling experience for the American people in the year 1962. To the credit side of the world's 1962 ledger should be put the end of the Algerian War and the establishment of an independent Algeria. Following 7 years of revolt in Algeria and unavailing efforts at forceful pacification, France, under the leadership of Charles de Gaulle, began a series of negotiations at Avignon in the spring of this year with the representatives of the Algerian Front of National Liberation, and accords were finally reached. The people of Algeria were given the right to choose, to vote on the issue of self-determination. And in July of this year, they voted overwhelmingly in favor of independence. And by that vote, French sovereignty in Algeria came to an end. Now, these Avignon Accords were violently resisted by the European diehards in Algeria. Bloodshed, massacres, and terror preceded and followed the liberation of Algeria. The last major decolonization act in the dismantling process of European imperial power, which has been going on for some time now all over the globe. As in all such cases of newly won independence, no orderly and peaceful transfer of authority took place. Algeria is still far from political stability. In fact, it finds itself at the moment in great turmoil and a condition approaching administrative and economic chaos. Panic-stricken French settlers have by the hundreds of thousands fled the country, including a large number of Jews. And with them, a massive flight of French capital. Business interests took place. And unemployment is rampant. There is a shortage of trained, competent men to run the government. And the various contending guerrilla groups and their leaders have not been disarmed and brought into obedience to the central authority under the present chief of staff, Mohammed Ben Bella. But after 7 years of cruel and costly civil war and the grossest and cruelest of repressive measures, this Algerian Gordian knot, which could not in any way be unraveled, had to be sharply cut. There was no other way out. And history assigned this hard and unpleasant task to Charles de Gaulle, and he did not shrink from it. He was denounced by many of his compatriots, still being denounced by them. Attempts to assassinate him were made. He was faced with a revolt of his leading generals, but he persisted, and he won through. The people of France sustained him time and again. They voted him sweeping powers. Recently, they voted to change the method of electing the French president, which de Gaulle advocates. Hereafter, the president of France will be elected by popular suffrage. They also gave him an overwhelming endorsement in the recent parliamentary elections. De Gaulle's party was swept into power. De Gaulle has thus given France stable government for the first time in a long time. He has put an end to the rule of the fragmentary parties which in the past, unable to agree among themselves, caused the downfall of governments in France time and again. Next to John F. Kennedy of the United States, Charles de Gaulle, in my judgment, is the man of the year in 1962. War broke out during last year between India and China. Fighting took place high up in the frozen Himalayas. And the fighting concerned a boundary dispute. The position of neither of the belligerents was made quite clear or appeared consistent. Red China, after sweeping the Indian troops before them and penetrating nearly 40 miles into Indian territory, called for a ceasefire and offered to withdraw. It is hard to see what Red China, hard-pressed at home by hunger and economic chaos, what Red China had to gain from an attack on India at this time. Was it to divert the attention of the harassed Chinese from their own domestic troubles? Or was it to establish Red China's hegemony in the communist world and to assert Peking's freedom of action and independence from Moscow? It is equally hard to follow the political involutions and convolutions of Nehru's India. Following the Chinese aggression, India did not break off diplomatic relations with China. India even voted at the very time these hostilities were going on to admit Red China into the United Nations. And India never brought its complaint to the United Nations. The United States rushed and is rushing military aid to the hard-pressed Indians at the very time that Nehru was negotiating with the Soviet Union for the MiG 21 jet fighters, which the Russians finally refused to send. We were responsible, I believe, for forcing the resignation of the anti-West defense minister, Krishna Menon. And we prodded India into negotiations long delayed, which India long resisted. We prodded India into negotiations with Pakistan for the settlement of their long-standing disputes, principally the one over Kashmir. But Nehru, thoroughly disillusioned, as he says, still remains a neutralist. This saintly preacher of peace to the rest of the world is not averse to playing the old game of power politics and to resort to force when the interest of India seem to be involved, as in Goa, Kashmir, and on the northern frontier. Let down by his communist friends, whose position he so often defended against the West, he is still the prolix preacher of moral platitudes to the rest of the world, hoping that the West will always be there to equip his armies whenever things go wrong. There are, in my judgment, no laurels and no world accolade for Nehru in 1962. The past year, my dear friends, was one of spectacular progress in the field of space exploration and applied science. Traveling for 109 days through 182 million miles of space, Mariner II, a 12-foot-high, 447-pound, instrument-packed space laboratory, came finally on the 14th of December within close range of the planet Venus and sent back valuable data about the planet and its surroundings, which scientists are now eagerly studying. It has been asserted that Mariner II, its data, will add more to man's knowledge of that planet than has been accumulated in all the 2,500 years of sky watching. On July 10th of this year, Telstar, the first communication satellite, was launched at Cape Canaveral, and it has successfully transmitted between the United States and Europe television, both in black and white and in color, telephone calls and photographs. It is generally agreed that from an applied science viewpoint, the successful launching and operation of Telstar is the most important development of the space age so far. And since then, another communication satellite, the Relay, has been orbited into space. Thus, a new age in satellite communication was born this last year. Truly, science is scoring one breathtaking victory after another. And one has the confident feeling that these remarkable achievements will go on and on indefinitely, opening new doors, probing new mysteries, adding to man's mastery and control over the forces of nature. December 2nd, of this year marked the 20th anniversary of the day when Enrico Fermi and his associates achieved the first self-sustaining nuclear chain reaction. Beneath the west stands of Stagg Field at the University of Chicago. And the atomic age was born 20 years ago this December. This was the exciting and epochal culmination of experiments which had been carried on in many parts of the world ever since Professor Albert Einstein in 1905, gave the scientific world his equation that energy is equal to mass times the square of the speed of light. Scientists since that time have labored to release the energy of the nucleus of the atom and to control that energy. And the success of Enrico Fermi not only made available for man a vast and almost inexhaustible source of new power, nuclear energy, but it marked a new stage in the evolution of human society. Enrico Fermi's achievement took place during World War II as a result of the urgent military needs of the United States at that time. It was quickly utilized for military purposes to make the atomic bombs which were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And since that time, it has been the military use of nuclear energy, rather than its peaceful use, which has preoccupied the attention of our country and also the attention of the Soviet Union. But now, the appalling potential of destructiveness of the nuclear bomb has fully dawned upon mankind. And with the world divided as it is into two hostile blocks, each in possession of the bomb and each capable of destroying the other, mankind has been brought to the most fatal crossroads in its history. Knowing that there is no defense against atomic weapons, mankind now faces the inescapable choice between the end of war or the end of man. And since man does not wish to destroy himself, it is, in my judgment, quite likely that he will find ways to put an end to war. This will not be easy, nor will it be quickly accomplished. Mankind will continue to live in dread uncertainty for a long time, skirting the abyss of total disaster, until the nations of the earth learn to adjust their obsessive desire for unconditioned national sovereignty and their doctrinaire insistence upon one economic system to the exclusion of all others. Until they will learn to adjust to the supreme and overriding need of human survival. And although the manner in which the statesmen and political leaders of the great world powers have acted in the last 20 years give little ground for optimism, for their political thinking and maneuvering has been, and to a large degree still is, of the vintage of the pre-nuclear age, and therefore dangerously obsolete. It is still a not unwarranted hope that the ushering in of the nuclear age 20 years ago may have actually brought in a new world order for man, and that a long hoped for age of universal peace is not too far off. And so, my dear friends, as we enter the new year, we enter it not without hope or confidence. We know of the many sore spots in the world where trouble is still brewing, the Congo, Berlin, Vietnam, Sino-Indian frontier. And we know of the many persistent problems which remain unsolved. The wretched economic plight of so many peoples in Latin America and Asia and Africa, and the resultant political and social unrest in those countries upon which communism eagerly preys. But we have experienced, I believe, a surge of confidence in our ability, in cooperation with our allies, to cope with these problems, given time. And we now believe that time will be given. We have lost our fears. We have regained the initiative in world affairs. We have set in operation plans and programs to help the underdeveloped peoples in Latin America and elsewhere. And these peoples are no longer suspicious of our motives, nor are they bewitched by communist propaganda anymore, by and large. The so-called neutral world is no longer a tail to the Soviet kite. And so I believe that 1963 should be a good year for the free world.